fur and leather and bronze scales, a bronze sword at his hip. His receding hair made him look older than his years. But as he turned to watch his bride approach, John could see the boy in him. His eyes were big as walnuts, though whether it was the fire, the priestess, or the woman that had put the fear in him, John could not say. Alice was more right than she knew.
"Who brings this woman to be wed?" asked Melisandre.
"I do," said John. "Now comes Alice of House Carstark, a woman grown and flowered, of noble blood and birth." He gave her hand one last squeeze and stepped back to join the others.
"Who comes forth to claim this woman?" asked Melisandre.
"Me." Sigorn slapped his chest. "Magna of Thin." "Sigorn," asked Melisandre, "will you share your fire with Alice and warm her when the night is dark and full of terrors?" "I swear me." The Magna's promise was a white cloud in the air. Snow dappled his shoulders. His ears were red. "By the red god's flames, I warm her all her days."
"Alice, do you swear to share your fire with Sigorn and warm him when the night is dark and full of terrors?" "Till his blood is boiling."
Her maiden's cloak was the black wool of the night's watch. The Carstark sunburst, sewn on its back, was made of the same white fur that lined it. Melisandre's eyes shone as bright as the ruby at her throat.
"Then come to me, and be as one."
As she beckoned, a wall of flames roared upwards, licking at the snowflakes with hot orange tongues. Alice Carstark took her Magna by the hand. Side by side, they leapt the ditch.
"Two went into the flames."
A gust of wind lifted the red woman's scarlet skirts till she pressed them down again.
"One emerges."
Her coppery hair danced about her head.
"What fire joins, none may put asunder."
"What fire joins, none may put asunder," came the echo, from Queen's men and Fens and even a few of the Black Brothers. "Except for kings and uncles," thought John Snow. Cregan Carstark had turned up a day behind his niece. With him came four mounted men-at-arms, a huntsman and a pack of dogs, sniffing after Lady Alice as if she were a deer. John Snow met them on the King's Road, half a league south of Molestown, before they could turn up at Castle Black, claim guest right, or call for parley. One of Carstark's men had loosed a crossbow quarrel at Tye, and died for it. That left four, and Cregan himself. Fortunately, they had a dozen ice cells, room for all. Like so much else, heraldry ended at the wall. The Fens had no family arms, as was customary amongst the nobles of the Seven Kingdoms, so John told the Stuarts to improvise. He thought they had done well. The bride's cloak, Sigorn fastened about Lady Alice's shoulders, showed a bronze disc on a field of white wool, surrounded by flames made with wisps of crimson silk. The echo of the Carstark sunburst was there for those who cared to look, but differenced to make the arms appropriate for House Thin. The Magna all but ripped the maiden's cloak from Alice's shoulders, but when he fastened her bride's cloak about her, he was almost tender. As he leaned down to kiss her cheek, their breath mingled. The flames roared once again. The Queen's men began to sing a song of praise.
"Is it done?" John heard Satin whisper.
"Done and done," muttered Molly, "and a good thing. They're wed, and I'm half-rose." He was muffled up in his best blacks, woolen so new they had hardly had a chance to fade yet. But the wind had turned his cheeks as red as his hair. "Hobbs mulled some wine with cinnamon and cloves. That'll warm us some."
"What cloves?" asked Owen the Oaf. The snow had started to descend more heavily, and the fire in the ditch was guttering out. The crowd began to break apart and stream from the yard, Queensmen, Kingsmen, and free folk alike, all anxious to get out of the wind and the cold.
"Will my lord be feasting with us?"
Molly asked John Snow. "Shortly. Sir Gawain might take it as a slight if he did not appear. And this marriage is mine own work, after all. I have other matters to attend to first, however." John crossed to Queen Selyse, with Ghost beside him. His boots crunched through piles of old snow. It was growing ever more time-consuming to shovel out the paths from one building to another. More and more, the men were resorting to the underground passages they called wormways.
"Such a beautiful rite," the Queen was saying. "I could feel our Lord's fiery gaze upon us. Oh, you cannot know how many times I have begged Stannis to let us be wed again. A true joining of body and spirit, blessed by the Lord of Light. I know that I could give his grace more children if we were bound in fire."
"To give him more children, you would first need to get him into your bed." Even at the wall, it was common knowledge that Stannis Baratheon had shunned his wife for years. One could only imagine how his grace had responded to the notion of a second wedding in the midst of his war. John bowed. "If it please your grace, the feast awaits." The Queen glanced at Ghost suspiciously, then raised her head to John.
"To be sure, Lady Melisandre knows the way."
The Red Priestess spoke up.
"I must attend my fires, your grace. Perhaps Willow will vouchsafe me a glimpse of his grace.
A glimpse of some great victory, mayhaps."
"Oh," Queen Selyse looked stricken. "To be sure, let us pray for a vision from our lord."
"Satin, show her grace to her place," said John. Sir Melgorn stepped forward.
"I will escort her grace to the feast. We shall not require your, steward."
The way the man drew out the last word told John that he had been considering saying something else. "Boy? Pet? Whore?" John bowed again. "As you wish. I shall join you shortly." Sir Melagorn offered his arm, and Queen Selyse took it, stiffly. Her other hand settled on her daughter's shoulder. The royal ducklings fell in behind them as they made their way across the yard, marching to the music of the bells on the fool's hat.
"Under the sea the mermen feast on starfish soup, and all the serving men are crabs,"
Patchface proclaimed as they went.
I know, oh, oh, oh!"
Melisandre's face darkened.
"That creature is dangerous. Many a time I have glimpsed him in my flames. Sometimes there are skulls about him, and his lips are red with blood."
"I wonder you haven't had the poor man burned." All it would take was a word in the Queen's ear, and Patchface would feed her fires. "You see fools in your fire, but no hint of Stannis.
When I search for him, all I see is snow."
The same useless answer. Clydes had dispatched a raven to Deepwood Mott to warn the king of Arnulf Carstark's treachery, but whether the bird had reached his grace in time, John did not know. The Bravassé banker was off in search of Stannis as well, accompanied by the guides that John had given him. But between the war and weather, it would be a wonder if he found him. "Would you know if the king was dead?" John asked the Red Priestess.
"He is not dead. Stannis is the Lord's chosen, destined to lead the fight against the dark. I have seen it in the flames, read of it in ancient prophecy. When the red star bleeds and the darkness gathers, Azor Ahai shall be born again amidst smoke and salt to wake dragons out of stone.
Dragonstone is the place of smoke and salt.
John had heard all this before. Stannis Baratheon was the lord of Dragonstone, but he was not born there. He was born at Storm's End, like his brothers. He frowned. And what of Mance? Is he lost as well? What do your fires show?
The same, I fear. Only snow.
Snow. It was snowing heavily to the south, John knew. Only 2 days' ride from here. The King's Road was said to be impassable. Melisandre knows that, too. And to the east, a savage storm was raging on the Bay of Seals. At last report, the ragtag fleet they had assembled to rescue the free folk from Hardhome still huddled at Eastwatch by the sea, confined to port by the rough seas. You're seeing cinders dancing in the updraft.
I am seeing skulls. And you? I see your face every time I look into the flames. The danger that I warned you of grows very close now.
Daggers in the dark, I know. You will forgive my doubts, my lady. A grey girl on a dying horse, fleeing from a marriage? That was what you said.
I was not wrong.
You were not right. Alice is not Arya.
The vision was a true one. It was my reading that was false. I am as mortal as you, Jon Snow. All mortals err.
Even Lord Commanders. Mance Rayder and his spare wives had not returned, and Jon could not help but wonder whether the Red Woman had lied of a purpose. Is she playing her own game?
You would do well to keep your wolf beside you, my lord.
Ghost is seldom far. The dire wolf raised his head at the sound of his name. John scratched him behind the ears. But now you must excuse me. Ghost, with me. Carved from base of the wall, and closed with heavy wooden doors, the ice cells range from small to smaller. Some were big enough to allow a man to pace, others so small that prisoners were forced to sit. The smallest were too cramped to allow even that. John had given his chief captive the larger cell, a pail to shit in, enough furs to keep him from freezing, and a skin of wine. It took the guard some time to open his cell, as ice had formed inside the lock. Rusted hinges screamed like damned souls when Wick Whittlestick yanked the door wide enough for John to slip through. A faint fecal odor greeted him, though less overpowering than he'd expected. Even shit froze solid in such bitter cold. Jon Snow could see his own reflection dimly inside the icy walls. In one corner of the cell, a heap of furs was piled up almost to the height of a man.
"Cast out," said Jon Snow. "Wake up."
The furs stirred. Some had frozen together, and the frost that covered them glittered when they moved. An arm emerged, then a face, brown hair, tangled and matted and streaked with grey. Two fierce eyes, a nose, a mouth, a beard. Ice caked the prisoner's moustache, clumps of frozen snot.
"Snow!"
His breath steamed in the air, fogging the ice behind his head.
"You have no right to hold me, the laws of hospitality. You are no guest of mine. You came to the wall without my leave, armed, to carry off your niece against her will. Lady Alice was given bread and salt. She is a guest. You are a prisoner."
John let that hang for a moment, then said, "Your niece is wed." Cregan Karstark's lips skinned back from his teeth.
"Alice was promised to me."
Though past 50, he had been a strong man when he went into the cell. The cold had robbed him of that strength and left him stiff and weak.
"My lord father."
"Your father is a castellan, not a lord, and a castellan has no right to make marriage pacts.
My father Arnulf is lord of Carhold. A son comes before an uncle, by all the laws I know."
Cregan pushed himself to his feet and kicked aside the furs clinging to his ankles. Harrion is dead, or will be soon. A daughter comes before an uncle, too. If her brother is dead, Carhold belongs to Lady Ellis, and she has given her hand in marriage to Sigorn, Magna of Fen. A wildling, a filthy, murdering wildling. Kraken's hands closed into fists. The gloves that covered them were leather, lined with fur to match the cloak that hung matted and stiff from his broad shoulders. His black wool surcoat was emblazoned with the white sunburst of his house. I see what you are, Snow. Half a wolf and half a wildling, base-born get of a traitor and a whore. You would deliver a high-born maid to the bed of some stinking savage. Did you sample her yourself first? He laughed. If you mean to kill me, do it, and be damned for a kinslayer. Stark and Carstock are one blood. My name is Snow. Bastard. Guilty. Of that, at least. Let this Magna come to Carhold. We'll hack off his head and stuff it in a privy, so we can piss into his mouth. Sigorn leads 200 thins, John pointed out, and Lady Alice believes Carhold will open its gates to her. Two of your men have already sworn her their service, and confirmed all she had to say concerning the plans your father made with Ramsay Snow. You have close kin at Carhold, I am told. A word from you could save their lives. Yield the castle. Lady Alice will pardon the women who betrayed her, and allow the men to take the black. Kraken shook his head. Chunks of ice formed about the tangles in his hair, and clicked together softly when he moved. Never, he said, never, never, never. I should make his head a wedding gift for Lady Alice and her Magna, John thought, but dared not take the risk. The Night's Watch took no part in the quarrels of the realm. Some would say he had already given Stannis too much help. Behead this fool, and they will claim I'm killing Northmen to give their lands to wildlings. Release him, and he will do his best to rip apart all I've done with Lady Alice and the Magna. John wondered what his father would do, how his uncle might deal with this. But Eddard Stark was dead. Benjamin Stark lost in the frozen wilds beyond the wall. You know nothing, Jon Snow. Never is a long time, Jon said. You may feel differently on the morrow, or a year from now. Soon or late, King Stannis will return to the wall, however. When he does, he will have you put to death, unless it happens that you are wearing a black cloak. When a man takes the black, his crimes are wiped away. Even such a man as you. Now pray excuse me. I have a feast to attend. After the biting cold of the ice cells, the crowded cellar was so hot that John felt suffocated from the moment he came down the steps. The air smelled of smoke and roasting meat and mulled wine. Axel Thorant was making a toast as John took his place upon the dais. To King Stannis and his wife, Queen Selyse, Light of the North, Sir Axel bellowed. To R'hllor, the Lord of Light, may he defend us all. One land, one God, one king. One land, one God, one king, the Queen's men echoed. John drank with the rest. Whether Alice Carstock would find any joy in her marriage, he could not say. But this one night, at least, should be one of celebration. The stewards began to bring out the first dish, an onion broth flavored with bits of goat and carrot. Not precisely royal fare, but nourishing. It tasted well enough, and warmed the belly. Owen the Oaf took up his fiddle, and several of the free folk joined in with pipes and drums. The same pipes and drums they played to sound Manse Raider's attack upon the wall. John thought they sounded sweeter now. With the broth came loaves of coarse brown bread, warm from the oven. Salt and butter sat upon the tables. The sight made John gloomy.
They were well provided with salt, Bowen Marsh had told him, but the last of the butter would be gone within a moon's turn. Old Flint and the Norrie had been given places of high honour just below the dais. Both men had been too old to march with Stannis. They had sent their sons and grandsons in their stead. But they had been quick enough to descend on Castle Black for the wedding. Each had brought a wet nurse to the wall as well. The Norrie woman was 40, with the biggest breasts John had ever seen. The Flint girl was 14, and flat-chested as a boy, though she did not lack for milk. Between the two of them, the child, Val called Munster, seemed to be thriving. For that much John was grateful. But he did not believe for a moment that two such hoary old warriors would have hied down from their hills for that alone. Each had brought a tale of fighting men, 5 for old Flint, 12 for the Norrie, all clad in ragged skins and studded leathers, fearsome as the face of winter. Some had long beards, some had scars, some had both. All worshipped the old gods of the north, those same gods worshipped by the free folk beyond the wall. Yet here they sat, drinking to a marriage hallowed by some queer red god from beyond the seas. Better that than refuse to drink. Neither Flint nor Norrie had turned their cups over to spill their wine upon the floor. That might betoken a certain acceptance. Or perhaps they just hate to waste good southern wine. They will not have tasted much of it up in those stony hills of theirs. Between courses, Sir Axel Florent led Queen Selyse out onto the floor to dance. Others followed. The Queen's knights first, partnered with her ladies. Sir Bruss gave Princess Shireen her first dance, then took a turn with her mother. Sir Narbet danced with each of Selyse's lady companions in turn. The Queen's men outnumbered the Queen's ladies 3-1, so even the humbler serving girls were pressed into the dance. After a few songs, a few black brothers remembered skills learned at the courts and castles of their youth, before their sins had sent them to the wall, and took the floor as well. That old rogue, Ulmer, of the Kingswood, proved as adept at dancing as he was at archery, no doubt regaling his partners with his tales of the Kingswood Brotherhood, when he rode with Simon Toyne and Big Belly Ben and helped Wenda the White Fawn burn her mark in the buttocks of her high-born captives. Saturn was all grace, dancing with 3 serving girls in turn, but never presuming to approach a high-born lady. John judged that wise. He did not like the way some of the Queen's knights were looking at the steward, particularly Sir Patrick of King's Mountain. "That one wants to shed a bit of blood," he thought. "He's looking for some provocation." When Owen the Oaf began to dance with Patchface, the fool, laughter echoed off the vaulted ceiling. The sight made Lady Alice smile.
"Do you dance often here at Castle Black?"
"Every time we have a wedding, my lady."
"You could dance with me, you know. It would be only courteous. You dance with me anon."
"Anon?" teased John.
"When we were children." She tore off a bit of bread and threw it at him. "As you know well."
"My lady should dance with her husband."
"My Magna is not one for dancing, I fear. If you will not dance with me, at least pour me some of the mulled wine."
"As you command." He signalled for a flagon.
"So," said Alice, as John poured, "I am now a woman wed, a wilding husband with his own little wilding army."
"Free folk is what they call themselves. Most, at least. The Fens are a people apart, though. Very old." Ygritte had told him that. "You know nothing, Jon Snow. They come from a hidden vale at the north end of the Frostfangs, surrounded by high peaks, and for thousands of years they've had more truck with the giants than with other men. It made them different.
Different, she said, but more like us.
Aye, my lady, the Fens have lords and laws. They know how to kneel. They mine tin and copper for bronze, forge their own arms and armor instead of stealing it. A proud folk and brave. Mansrader had to best the old Magna thrice before Stir would accept him as king beyond the wall. And now they are here, on our side of the wall, driven from their mountain fastness and into my bedchamber. She smiled a wry smile. It is my own fault. My lord father told me I must charm your brother Rob, but I was only six and didn't know how.
Aye, but now you're almost 6 and 10, and we must pray you will know how to charm your new husband. My lady, how do things stand at Carhold with your food stores?
Not well, Alice sighed.
My father took so many of our men south with him that only the women and young boys were left to bring the harvest in. Them and the men too old or crippled to go off to war. Crops withered in the fields or were pounded into the mud by autumn rains. And now the snows are come. This winter will be hard. Few of the old people will survive it, and many children will perish as well.
It was a tale that any Northman knew well. My father's grandmother was a Flint of the mountains, on his mother's side, John told her. The first Flints, they call themselves. They say the other Flints are the blood of younger sons, who had to leave the mountains to find food and land and wives. It has always been a harsh life up there. When the snows fall and food grows scarce, their young must travel to the winter town or take service at one castle or the other. The old men gather up what strength remains in them and announce that they are going hunting. Some are found come spring. More are never seen again.
It is much the same at Carhold.
That did not surprise him.
When your stores begin to dwindle, my lady, remember us. Send your old men to the wall. Let them say our words. Here, at least, they will not die alone in the snow, with only memories to warm them. Send us boys as well, if you have boys to spare.
As you say,
she touched his hand, Carhold remembers.
The elk was being carved. It smelled better than John had any reason to expect. He dispatched a portion to Leathers out at Harden's Tower, along with 3 big platters of roast vegetables for one, then ate a healthy slice himself.
Three-finger Hubs acquitted himself well. That had been a concern. Hub had come to him 2 nights ago, complaining that he'd joined the night's watch to kill wildlings, not to cook for them.
"Besides, I never done no wedding feast, my lord. Black brothers don't never take no wives. It's in the bloody vows. I swear it is."
John was washing the roast down with a sip of mulled wine when Clydes appeared at his elbow.
"A bird," he announced,
and slipped a parchment into John's hand. The note was sealed with a dot of hard black wax. Eastwatch, John knew, even before he broke the seal. The letter had been written by Maester Harmoon. Cotter Pike could neither read nor write, but the words were Pike's, set down as he had spoken them, blunt and to the point.
"Calm seas today. 11 ships set sail for Hartholm on the morning tide. 3 bravosses, 4 Lyseni, 4 of ours. 2 of the Lyseni barely seaworthy. We may drown more wildlings than we save. Your command, 20 ravens aboard, and Maester Harmoon. We'll send reports. I command from Talon, Tattersalt, 2nd on Blackbird. Sir Glendon holds East Watch."
"Dark wings, dark words?" asked Alice Carstark.
No, my lady. This news was long awaited, though the last part troubles me. Glendon Hewitt was a seasoned man and a strong one, a sensible choice to command in Cutter Pike's absence. but he was also as much a friend as Alistair Thorne could boast, and a crony of sorts with Janus Slint, however briefly. John could still recall how Hewitt had dragged him from his bed, and the feel of his boot slamming into his ribs. Not the man I would have chosen. He rolled the parchment up and slipped it into his belt. The fish course was next, but as the pike was being boned, Lady Alice dragged the Magnar up onto the floor. From the way he moved, it was plain that Sigorn had never danced before, but he had drunk enough mulled wine so that it did not seem to matter.
A northern maid and a wilding warrior, bound together by the Lord of Light.
Sir Axel Florent slipped into Lady Alice's vacant seat.
Her Grace approves. I am close to her, my lord, so I know her mind. King Stannis will approve as well.
Unless Roose Bolton has struck his head on a spear.
Not all agree, alas.
Sir Axel's beard was a ragged brush beneath his sagging chin. Coarse hair sprouted from his ears and nostrils.
Sir Patrick feels he would have made a better match for Lady Alice. His lands were lost to him when he came north.
There are many in this hall who have lost far more than that, said John, and more who have given up their lives in service to the realm. Sir Patrick should count himself fortunate. Axel Florent smiled.
The king might say the same if he were here. Yet some provision must be made for his grace's leal knights, surely. They have followed him so far and at such cost, and we must needs bind these wildlings to king and realm. This marriage is a good first step, but I know that it would please the queen to see the wildling princess wed as well.
John sighed. He was weary of explaining that Val was no true princess. No matter how often he told them, they never seemed to hear.
You are persistent, Sir Axel. I grant you that. Do you blame me, my lord? Such a prize is not easily won. A nubile girl, I hear, and not hard to look upon. Good hips, good breasts, well made for whelping children.
Who would father these children? Sir Patrick? You?
Who better? We Florens have the blood of the old gardener kings in our veins. Nelly Melisandre could perform the rites, as she did for Lady Alice and the Magna.
All you are lacking is a bride.
Easily remedied.
Florence's smile was so forced that it looked painful.
Where is she, Lord Snow? Have you moved her to one of your other castles, Greyguard or the Shadow Tower, Horsborough with t'other wenches?
He leaned close.
Some say you have her tucked away for your own pleasure. Makes no matter to me, so long as she is not with child. I'll get my own sons on her. If you've broken her to saddle, well, we are both men of the world, are we not?
John had heard enough. Sir Axel, if you are truly the Queen's hand, I pity her grace. Florence's face grew flushed with anger.
So it is true. You mean to keep her for yourself. I see it now. The bastard wants his father's seat.
The bastard refused his father's seat. If the bastard had wanted Val, all he had to do was ask for her.
You must excuse me, sir, he said. I need a breath of fresh air.
It stinks in here. His head turned.
That was a horn.
Others had heard it too. The music and the laughter died at once. Dancers froze in place, listening. Even Ghost pricked up his ears.
"Did you hear that?"
Queen Selyse asked her knights.
"A war horn, Your Grace," said Sir Narbot.
The Queen's hand went fluttering to her throat.
"Are we under attack?"
"No, Your Grace," said Ulmer of the Kingswood. "It's a watchers on the wall, is all."
"One blast," thought Jon Snow. "Rangers returning."
Then it came again. The sound seemed to fill the cellar.
"Two blasts," said Nolly.
Black brothers, Northmen, free folk, thens, queen's men, all of them fell quiet, listening. 5 heartbeats passed. 10. 20. Then Owen the Oaf tittered, and John Snow could breathe again. 2 blasts, he announced. Wildlings. Val. Tormund Giantsbane had come at last.
Daenerys. The hall rang to Yonkish laughter, Yonkish songs, Yonkish prayers. Dancers danced, musicians played queer tunes with bells and squeaks and bladders. Singers sang ancient love songs in the incomprehensible tongue of old Gith. Wine flowed, not the thin pale stuff of Slaver's Bay, but rich sweet vintages from the Arbor, and dream wine from Carth, flavoured with strange spices. The Yunkai had come at King Hisdar's invitation to sign the peace and witness the rebirth of Meereen's far-famed fighting pits. Her noble husband had opened the Great Pyramid to fate them.
"I hate this," thought Daenerys Targaryen. "How did this happen, that I'm drinking and smiling with men I'd sooner flay?"
A dozen different sorts of meat and fish were served. Camel, crocodile, singing squid, lacquered ducks, and spiny grubs, with goat and ham and horse for those whose tastes were less exotic, plus dog. No Giscari feast was complete without a course of dog. Hisdar's cooks prepared dog 4 different ways.
"Giscari will eat anything that swims or flies or crawls, but for man and dragon," Daria had warned her. "And I'll wager they'll eat dragon too, if given half a chance."
Meat alone does not make a meal, though. So there were fruits and grains and vegetables as well. The air was redolent with the scents of saffron, cinnamon, cloves, pepper and other costly spices. Danny scarce touched a bite.
"This is peace," she told herself. "This is what I wanted, what I worked for. This is why I married Hisdar. So why does it taste so much like defeat?"
"It is only for a little while more, my love," Hisdar had assured her. "The Yunkai will soon be gone, and their allies and hirelings with them. We shall have all we desired, peace, food, trade. Our port is open once again, and ships are being permitted to come and go."
"They are permitting that, yes," she had replied. "But their warships remain. They can close their fingers around our throat again whenever they wish. They have opened a slave market within sight of my walls."
"Outside our walls, sweet queen, and that was a condition of the peace, that Yunkai would be free to trade in slaves as before, unmolested."
"In their own city, not where I have to see it."
The wise masters had established their slave pens and auction block just south of the Skarhazadan, where the wide brown river flowed into Slaver's Bay.
"They are mocking me to my face, making a show of how powerless I am to stop them."
"Posing and posturing," said her noble husband. "A show, as you have said. Let them have their mummery. When they are gone, we will make a fruit market of what they leave behind."
"When they are gone," Danny repeated. "And when will they be gone? Riders have been seen beyond the Skarhazadan. Dothraki scouts, Rakaro says, with a Khalasar behind them. They will have captives, men, women, and children, gifts for the slavers."
Dothraki did not buy or sell, but they gave gifts and received them.
"That is why the Yunkai have thrown up this market. They will leave here with thousands of new slaves."
Hisdar Zolorek shrugged. "But they will leave. That is the important part, my love. Yunkai will trade in slaves. Meereen will not. This is what we have agreed. Endure this for a little while longer, and it shall pass." So Daenerys sat silent through the meal,
wrapped in a vermilion toga and black thoughts, speaking only when spoken to, brooding on the men and women being bought and sold outside her walls, even as they feasted here within the city. Let her noble husband make the speeches and laugh at the feeble Yunkish japes. That was a king's right, and a king's duty. Much of the talk about the table was of the matches to be fought upon the morrow. Barsena Blackhair was going to face a boar, his tusks against her dagger. Kraz was fighting, as was the spotted cat. And in the day's final pairing, Gogor the giant would go against Bellaquo Bonebreaker. One would be dead before the sun went down.
No queen has clean hands, Danny told herself.
She thought of Doria, of Quaro, of Eroa, of a little girl she had never met, whose name had been Hazea.
Better a few should die in the pit than thousands at the gates. This is the price of peace. I pay it willingly. If I look back, I am lost.
The Yunkish Supreme Commander, Yerkes Zoyunzak, might have been alive during Aegon's conquest, to judge by his appearance. Bent-backed, wrinkled and toothless, he was carried to the table by two strapping slaves. The other Yunkish lords were hardly more impressive. One was small and stunted, though the slave soldiers who attended him were grotesquely tall and thin. The third was young, fit and dashing, but so drunk that Danny could scarce understand a word he said.
How could I have been brought to this pass by creatures such as these?
The sellswords were a different matter. Each of the four free companies serving Yunkai had sent its commander. The Windblown were represented by the Pentoshi nobleman known as the Tattered Prince, the Long Lances by the Gyro Regan, who looked more shoemaker than soldier and spoke in murmurs. Bloodbeard, from the company of the cat, made enough noise for him and a dozen more. A huge man with a great bush of beard and a prodigious appetite for wine and women. He bellowed, belched, farted like a thunderclap, and pinched every serving girl who came within his reach. From time to time he would pull one down into his lap to squeeze her breasts and fondle her between the legs. The second sons were represented too.
If Dario were here, this meal would end in blood.
No promised peace could have ever persuaded her captain to permit Brown Ben Plum to stroll back into Meereen and leave alive. Danny had sworn that no harm would come to the seven envoys and commanders, though that had not been enough for the Yunkai. They had required hostages of her as well. To balance the three Yunkish nobles and four sellswort captains, Meereen sent seven of its own out to the siege camp. Hisdar's sister, two of his cousins, Danae's blood rider, Jogo, her admiral, Grolio, the unsullied captain, Hero, and Dario Naharis.
I will leave my girls with you,
her captain had said, handing her his sword belt and its gilded wantons.
Keep them safe from me, beloved. We would not want them making bloody mischief amongst the Yunkai.
The shave-pate was absent as well. The first thing Hisdar had done upon being crowned was to remove him from command of the brazen beasts, replacing him with his own cousin, the plump and pasty Marga Zolorek.
It is for the best. The Green Grace says there is blood between Lorek and Kandak, and the shave-pate never made a secret of his disdain for my lord husband. And Dario...
Dario had only grown wilder since her wedding. Her peace did not please him. Her marriage pleased him less. And he had been furious at being deceived by the Dornishmen. When Prince Quentin told them that the other Westerosi had come over to the Stormcrows, at the command of the Tattered Prince, only the intercession of Grey Worm and his Unsullied prevented Dario from killing them all. The forced deserters had been imprisoned safely in the bowels of the pyramid. But Dario's rage continued to fester.
"He will be safer as a hostage. My captain was not made for peace."
Danny could not risk his cutting down of Brown Ben Plum, making muck of Hisdar before the court, provoking the Yunkai, or otherwise upsetting the agreement that she had given up so much to win. Dario was war and woe. Henceforth, she must keep him out of her bed, out of her heart, and out of her. If he did not betray her, he would master her. She did not know which of those she feared the most. When the gluttony was done, and all the half-eaten food had been cleared away, to be given to the boar, who gathered below, at the queen's insistence, tall glass flutes were filled with a spice liquor from Carth, as dark as amber. Then began the entertainments. A troop of Yunkish castrati, owned by Yerkes Zelyanzak, sang them songs in the ancient tongue of the old empire, their voices high and sweet and impossibly pure.
"Have you ever heard such singing, my love?" Hisdar asked her. "They have the voices of gods, do they not?" "Yes," she said, "though I wonder if they might not have preferred to have the fruits of men."
All of the entertainers were slaves. That had been part of the peace, that slave owners be allowed the right to bring their chattel into Meereen without fear of having them freed. In return, the Yunkai had promised to respect the rights and liberties of the former slaves that Danny had freed. "A fair bargain," Hisdar said, but the taste it left in the queen's mouth was foul. She drank another cup of wine to wash it out.
"If it please you, Yerkes will be pleased to give us the singers, I do not doubt," her noble husband said. "A gift to seal our peace, an ornament to our court."
"He will give us these castrati," Danny thought, "and then he will march home and make some more. The world is full of boys." The tumblers who came next failed to move her either, even when they formed a human pyramid 9 levels high, with a naked little girl on top.
"Is that meant to represent my pyramid?"
the queen wondered.
"Is the girl on top meant to be me?"
Afterward, her lord husband led his guests onto the lower terrace, so the visitors from the Yellow City might behold Meereen by night. Wine cups in hand, the Yunkai wandered the garden in small groups, beneath lemon trees and night-blooming flowers, and Danny found herself face to face with Brown Ben Plum. He bowed low.
"Worship, you look lovely. Well, you always did. None of them Yunkish men are half so pretty. I thought I might bring a wedding gift for you, but the bidding went too high for old Brown Ben."
"I want no gifts from you."
"This one you might, the head of an old foe."
"Your own," she said sweetly. "You betrayed me."
"Now that's a harsh way of putting it, if you don't mind me saying."
Brown Ben scratched at his speckled grey and white whiskers.
"We went over to the winning side, is all. Same as we done before. It weren't all me, neither. I put it to my men."
"So they betrayed me. Is that what you're saying? Why? Did I mistreat the second sons? Did I cheat you on your pay?"
"Never that," said Brown Ben. "But it's not all about the coin, your high and mightiness. I learned that a long time back at my first battle. Morning after the fight, I was rooting through the dead, looking for the odd bit of plunder, as it were. Came upon this one corpse. Some axeman had taken his whole arm off at the shoulder. He was covered with flies, all crusty, with dried blood. Might be why no one else had touched him, but under them he wore this studded jerkin, looked to be good leather. I figured it might fit me well enough, so I chased away the flies and cut it off him. The damn thing was heavier than it had any right to be, though. Under the lining he'd sewn a fortune in coin. Gold, your worship, sweet yellow gold. enough for any man to live like a lord for the rest of his days. But what good did it do him? There he was, with all his coin lying in the blood and mud, with his fucking arm cut off. And that's a lesson, see? Silver is sweet and gold's our mother, but once you're dead, they're worth less than that last shit you take as you lie dying. I told you once, there are old sellswords and there are bold sellswords, but there are no old bold sellswords. My boys didn't care to die, that's all. And when I told them that you couldn't unleash them dragons against the Yunkishmen, well...
You saw me as defeated, Danny thought. And who am I to say that you were wrong? I understand.
She might have ended it there, but she was curious.
Enough gold to live like a lord, you said. What did you do with all that wealth?
Brown Ben laughed.
Fool boy that I was. I told a man I took to be my friend, and he told our sergeant and my brothers in arms, come and relieve me of that burden. Sergeant said I was too young, that I'd only wasted all on whores and such. He let me keep the jerkin, though, he spat. You don't never want to trust a sellsword, m'lady.
I have learned that much. One day I must be sure to thank you for the lesson.
Brown Ben's eyes crinkled up.
No need. I know the sort of thanks you have in mind.
He bowed again and moved away. Danny turned to gaze out over her city. Beyond her walls, the yellow tents of the Yunkai stood in orderly rows beside the sea, protected by the ditches their slaves had dug for them. Two armed legions out of New Gis, trained and armed in the same fashion as on Solid, were encamped across the river to the north. Two more Gascari legions had made camp to the east, choking off the road to the Kaizai Pass. The horse lines and cook fires of the free companies lay to the south. By day, thin plumes of smoke hung against the sky like ragged grey ribbons. By night, distant fires could be seen. Hard by the bay was the abomination, the slave market, at her door. She could not see it now, with the sunset, but she knew that it was there. That just made her angrier.
"Sir Barristan,"
she said softly. The white knight appeared at once.
"Your Grace?"
"How much did he hear?"
"Enough. He was not wrong. Never trust a sellsword."
"Or a queen," thought Danny. "Is there some man in the Second Sons who might be persuaded to remove Brown Ben?"
"As Dario Naharis once removed the other captains of the Storm Crows." The old knight looked uncomfortable.
"Perhaps. I would not know, Your Grace." "No," she thought, "you are too honest and too honorable. If not, the Yunkai employ three other companies.
Rogues and cutthroats, scum of 100 battlefields," Sir Barristan warned, "with captains full as treacherous as plum."
"I'm only a young girl and know little of such things, but it seems to me that we want them to be treacherous. Once, you'll recall, I convinced the Second Sons and Stormcrows to join us.
If Your Grace wishes a privy word with Gilo Reagan or the Tattered Prince, I could bring them up to your apartments."
"This is not the time. Too many eyes, too many ears. Their absence would be noted, even if you could separate them discreetly from the Yunkai. We must find some quieter way of reaching out to them. Not tonight, but soon."
"As you command. Though I fear this is not a task for which I am well suited. In King's Landing, work of this sort was left to Lord Littlefinger or the Spider. We old knights are simple men, only good for fighting." He patted his sword hilt.
"Our prisoners," suggested Danny, "the Westerosi who came over from the Windblown with the three Dornishmen, we still have them in cells, do we not? Use them."
Free them, you mean? Is that wise? They were sent here to worm their way into your trust, so they might betray your grace at the first chance.
Then they failed. I do not trust them. I will never trust them.
If truth be told, Danae was forgetting how to trust.
We can still use them. One was a woman, Maris. Send her back as a gesture of my regard. If their captain is a clever man, he will understand.
The woman is the worst of all.
All the better.
Danae considered a moment.
We should sound out the Long Lancers, too, and the Company of the Cat.
Bloodbeard, Sir Barristan's frown deepened. If it please your grace, we want no part of him. Your grace is too young to remember the Ninepenny Kings, but this Bloodbeard is cut from the same savage cloth. There is no honour in him, only hunger for gold, for glory, for blood.
You know more of such men than I, sir.
If Bloodbeard were truly the most dishonourable and greedy of the sellswords, he might be the easiest to sway. But she was loath to go against Sir Barristan's counsel in such matters.
Do as you think best, but do it soon. If Histar's peace should break, I want to be ready. I do not trust the slavers.
I do not trust my husband.
They will turn on us at the first sign of weakness.
The young kai grow weaker as well. The bloody flux has taken hold amongst the Tolothi, it is said, and spread across the river to the 3rd Giscari Legion.
The Pale Mare,
Daenerys sighed.
Quaithe warned me of the Pale Mare's coming. She told me of the Dornish Prince as well, the Sun's Son. She told me much and more, but all in riddles. I cannot rely on plague to save me from my enemies. Set pretty Maris free, at once.
As you command, though, your grace, if I may be so bold, there is another road.
The Dornish Road,
Dennis sighed. The three Dornishmen had been at the feast, as befit Prince Quentin's rank, though Resnick had taken care to seat them as far as possible from her husband. Histar did not seem to be of a jealous nature, but no man would be pleased by the presence of a rival suitor near his new bride.
The boy seems pleasant and well-spoken, but
Hasmartil is ancient and noble, and has been a leal friend to Has Targaryen for more than a century, your grace. I had the honour of serving with Prince Quentin's great-uncle in your father's Seven. Prince Lewin was as valiant a brother-in-arms as any man could wish for. Quentin Martell is of the same blood, if it please your grace.
It would please me if he had turned up with these 50,000 swords he speaks of. Instead, he brings two knights and a parchment. Will a parchment shield my people from the Yunkai? If he had come with a fleet,
Sunspear has never been a sea power, your grace.
No.
Danny knew enough of Westerosi history to know that. Nymeria had landed 10,000 ships upon Dorne's sandy shores. But when she wed her Dornish prince, she had burned them all and turned her back upon the sea forever.
Dorne is too far away. To please this prince, I would need to abandon all my people. You should send him home.
Dornishmen are notoriously stubborn, your grace. Prince Quentin's forebears fought your own for the better part of 200 years. He will not go without you.
Then he will die here, Daenerys thought, unless there is more to him than I can see. Is he still within?
Drinking with his knights.
Bring him to me. It is time he met my children.
A flicker of doubt passed across the long, solemn face of Barristan Selmy. As you command. Her king was laughing with Yerkaz Zoyunsek and the other Yunkish lords. Danny did not think that he would miss her, but just in case, she instructed her handmaids to tell him that she was answering a call of nature, should he inquire after her.
Sir Barristan was waiting by the steps with the Dornish prince. Martell's square face.